Oh, this one's always great. Sing a song about love. Be back in a couple minutes here with Walter Bosley and his new book, Origin, the 19th century source of breakaway civilizations. Is that what it's called? Yeah, well, he'll get mad at me when he gets in here.
Warping my mind. Sing a song about love. Some nude woman is found at the bottom of a swimming pool. Some young hoodlum robs a grocery store and they shoot the fool. A sucker gets caught with another man's wife. He gets chopped up with a butcher knife. Shut it off. Sing a song about love. Some protester is burning his body in gasoline. Some young drunk runs over a bridge in his flaming machine. While maniacs burning buildings down, a girl leaps 40 stories to the ground. Shut it off, sing a song about love. Sing a song about love. Sing a song about love. A boy and girl in each other's arms like a pair of mating doves. Children looking at war and violence on a TV screen. Their parents wonder why they grow up to be hateful and mean. Mommies and daddies fighting night after night. The kids growing up thinking this is life. Shut it off, sing a song about love. Sing a song about love. Sing a song about love. A boy and girl in each other's arms like a pair of mating doves.
And maybe we should start. Have you heard the new intro?
No, I don't think so.
Listen to this intro; you'll like it.
No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain. Away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by, you know, aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information. And the fact that they can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we conditioned here? Yes.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
And we're not going to waste time with music that you've already heard 3,000 times. It's a Radio Mysterioso. Obviously, it's Radio Mysterioso, or you wouldn't be listening. Walter has returned.
Yes,
Walter Bosley. Most recently author of Origin, the 19th century emergence of the 20th century breakaway civilization.
That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I was showing him the author proof of It Defies Language.
Excellent cover. Good job, RPJ. Ooh, and a bookmark.
Yeah.
Very nice. This is high speed. This looks professional.
Yeah, he said, RPJ said, why don't you make some bookmarks? You can hand them out at the convention. So I, the bookmark's yours.
No.
And I said, that's a good idea. So he did the layout so that it would fit on a bookmark. A bunch of them. So it would fit on a bookmark, and I had a place print them up, and they look nice.
Back when I was doing traditional publishing, yeah, cool. Bookmarks were something that I would print up several, and they were one of my favorite things to do.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I guess they is this a taller microphone stand? You might be able to use this and not have to lean down. Wait.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So anyway, let me switch mic stands.
Sorry, this one actually extends.
I'm not going to add to that. I was going to say, how appropriate. Mine extends.
That's a logical fallacy, Bill. Every time you have one on the show. Every time there's one on the show, we'll
wait. I'm on the show. You might as well put it away.
So, in contrast to other times you've been on the show, I read the whole damn book.
The whole thing?
Yes, and I finished it about 3 hours ago.
Oh, excellent. So yeah. It's fresh.
Yes, and the reason was, what was I reading before that? Oh my
Something
God, I can't
of
even remember. I was trying to get to the end of somebody else's book or another piece of literature or something. I can't even remember what I was reading. It made such a great impression on me. Anyway, we'll talk about your book.
Probably Friedrich Wielschaber's Salon of the Damned.
Close, but that's not it. Wow, my computer shut off. That's nice. Well, it doesn't affect our recordings, so.
Well, it's a Mac, right?
Yeah.
And I'm former FBI. I walk in the room, it shuts down.
Yeah, that's right. This was
a little topical humor.
Yes. Anyway. Oh, there it is. Are you sure you shut your computer down? No, I don't. So, Walter, how old is this book now? Like 2 months old?
I released it on New Year's Eve.
Oh, so it's like 3 months old.
Yeah.
Three and a
Well,
bit.
It's in its third month.
Yeah.
And
how's it doing?
It immediately became my most popular book.
Really?
Yes.
Because I saw a couple of the reviews and they were kind of ravey.
It is... The last 2 months, it's been by far my most popular book.
Why?
Well, I think it's the one I've done that's the most connected to anything with UFOs. Breakaway civilization topic is very hot right now, getting hotter.
That's the true part. I don't know if it has much of a connection to UFOs. It kind of in the text, it kind of makes an effort not to be connected.
There's a flying saucer on the cover, and
yeah, there is.
There is kind of a UFO thematic connection because what I'm doing is I'm trying to say, hey, there's an earthbound explanation for the UFO, so to speak, I'm saying that with air quotes, of the 19th century, and which might explain much of the UFO reports, sightings, and lore getting into the 20th century.
Right. Okay. I went along and wrote questions as I was reading it, which would help.
Okay.
So, Walter, you just mentioned breakaway civilization. For those of us who don't know what the hell that is, what's your definition? Or what is the definition? What are people excited about?
You know, and the
how does that differ from your definition in the book?
Because
it's a little bit different.
The lengthy formal definition people fall back on is usually Richard Dolan's, because he's the first one to spell it out as such. I do not have that memorized. Basically, what I say, it's a group of people with the resources who were fed up with this place and decided to do their own thing.
Right.
And of course, the key being with the resources. And the other key is where. Now, there could be a breakaway civilization that, you know, technically, you know, could be embedded within that which we live, but to me, that's not breakaway.
Yeah, kind of like a like a dark internet or something.
Yeah, breakaway to me is literally they don't live where we live, you know, at least the way I've approached it. And with what I present in the book, what I explore is they don't live around us, they don't live with us, and, you know, they have the resources where they don't need our resources. They don't need us.
How does that, do I get ahead of myself by saying, how does that manifest in the book? What breakaway civilization are you referring to in the book?
Well,
I will ask these obvious questions, Walter, even though I've read it and I'm sitting here in front of you.
So I refer actually specifically to two. I propose that there are two breakaway civilizations that have their roots in the 19th century. One of them is the better known, when you're talking about the lore, that is, those who are familiar with the lore of this. This would be the breakaway that was affiliated with a group called NIMSA, and who I argue led to the rise of the Nazis. And these would be, the NIMSA side would be those who we call the elites, the New World Order, the oligarchy. That everybody likes to, you know, say, hey, those are the bad guys. Those are the guys that want to bring us under a global government, blah, 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 so forth.
Right.
Well, the other one is one that is actually, and excuse me, this first one that I've described, they have the means where they can, you know, theoretically, where they could go off and do their own thing elsewhere, but they choose not to. They choose to just make us, you know, subordinate to them. The other one that I speak of is one that I think, I propose anyway, truly broke away from our civilization, our society, our world, and had the resources and broke out and went out and went away somewhere else. And I believe these two groups are in opposition to one another.
Yes. Although they're both specifically, I guess you would say politically or geographically affiliated. Or one of them definitely is, and the other one used to be, right?
Well, I think there's the, we'll call it that, the German group. Excuse me. The German group.
Yeah, I wouldn't have this on there either. They're disgusting.
Yeah, it's nasty. The German group, of course, is the one that, you know, is affiliated with the NIMSA, and they're the ones who are the elitists that people talk about. When you hear people talking about the bad breakaway civilization, that's who I identify as the NIMSA or the German group.
Which we will explain here.
Right.
For those who haven't heard the other shows, for previous books.
Yeah. And the other group, which I think started in the United States and was stood up by Americans, decided to ditch affiliation with America in the early 20th century. And whether you could call them American now, I refer to them in the book for simplicity's sake. But then I also tag onto them what I call the 1903, which is derived from the very fun and fanciful legend of a supposed possible journey to Mars in 1903. And I go into that in the book, and that's why I've been more often referring to this other group that was originally the American group. I refer to them as the 1903. So when you hear me say the 1903, the 1903, I'm referring to the year, and I'm referring to that so-called American group.
Right. We've already run into terms and things that if people haven't read the other books, probably don't know about, and will lead us into things in this book. Are you prepared to talk about anything in the book, I guess?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is NIMSA? What does it stand for? Why is it important? And how did you trace their origin? And then I'll ask you things, other things that'll make you go, what's wrong with you?
Well, first of all,
maybe.
NIMSA is a word that has been around in the lore of the airship mystery. And basically,
NYMZA.
It's
an acronym.
Yeah, it's essentially always spelled in caps when it's referred to. And it's easy to trace the origin of it because the first time that we know of right now that we ever heard the word NIMSA was in the writings of the legendary Charles Delshow, who we've talked about here in the past. The man affiliated with and who told the story of the Sonora Aero Club. And nobody could figure out what NIMSA actually stood for. There were some decent attempts. And those attempts, they were logical based on what little we knew. But unfortunately, the attempts to translate that in the past have been based on the NIMSA as associated with the 1890s airship mystery. The original source being Delshow, you have to go back to Delshow. And let's go back to the attempts at translation. Because it's NYMZA, people often said, well, you know, there's this talk of American investors in the East and in New York, so therefore NIMSA, NYMZA, must be New York something or other. And one writer came up with the New York Motor Zephyr Association, and that's reasonable because the lore.
Delshow, if people don't know, is somebody who made all these drawings of supposedly fanciful airships that were found in the that he did in the teens and 20s. They were found in a trash heap in the 1960s, I think 1968, and rescued. Most of them were rescued. The drawings were kept for quite a while by a couple different people. Now I think they're mostly owned by that Stephen Romano Gallery. Did they buy them all up?
Well, the DeMenil. Those of you who are up on your Torbit document, Gemstone File stuff, the DeMenil family is mentioned a bit in association with Permindex and all that shadowy stuff connected with the JFK assassination. Well, what's interesting is the DeMenils also showed great interest in the artwork of Charles Delshow when it emerged, and they own several of the drawings and paintings. So think about that.
I'm sorry I interrupted you. You were talking about the origin of NIMSA and how it was. It might have been New York Motor Zephyr Association, but
understand.
In your last book, you decided it wasn't.
Right. It was in Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora, in which I reveal that the mysterious Cora Stanton was most likely Etta Place, of Butch Cassidy fame. And she had an affiliation with this milieu. And in that book, I reveal my translation of NIMSA, and I drew this idea from Delshow's own words. Delshow says that NIMSA was a German-based organization. It was headquartered in Germany. So therefore, in my view...
Which is where he was from.
Which originally. Is where Delshow was from. So therefore, in my view, NIMSA had to be an acronym for a German organization. So therefore, the words in the acronym were German. Now, without going into it too length, because that's a couple of books back, remember, the original stuff, my original translation logic and all that is in Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora. I do represent it in this book, Origin, And basically, what I came up with was is that NIMSA is not only an acronym, but it is a transliteration of an acronym. Real quick, those of you who haven't studied languages or linguistics, a transliteration is when you use the alphabet of one particular language to phonetically spell words of another language so the people of language A can properly pronounce language B, okay? And so, therefore, it may not be the exact letters of the source word. Right. So, therefore, and again, I go into this in two books, so you can read it in the books.
But, right.
So, therefore, NYMZA, in my opinion, becomes NJMZ lowercase a, NIMSA. And again, the details are in the books, but I come to the conclusion that it means in German, Nationalistische Jagdflugzeug Maschinen Gesellschaft, which is essentially the nationalist pursuit airship program office. Nationalist Pursuit Airship Program Office.
Okay.
Which is basically, it's not national, it's nationalist, which is a more political connotation than an official government affiliation. It was
right.
a private group.
Okay. And the reason you said nationalist is because at that point you were pointing out that Germany was not a...
That's right. It was a bunch of separate Prussian states. In the 1850s.
Yeah.
And this was the era of the Sonora Aero Club. And the NIMSA, in my opinion, was... an organization that was the product of this era of a push towards nationalism. Germany, as we know it, did not exist in the 1850s. And the guys who would have been behind a group like NIMSA would also have been nationalists. They would have been all for a unified Germany.
Right. So why did a group of people from Germany... How were they connected with a group of people in the United States in Sonora, California, in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains, trying to make things fly and maybe doing it?
Well,
Trying to invent and fly flying machines.
Essentially, again, in the 18...
According to Del Show.
Yeah. In the 1850s, due to the political upheavals going on in what we call Germany, there were a lot of German immigrants, German-Prussian immigrants, to the Americas and specifically to the United States. Now, the issue of the flying machines and playing around allegedly with anti-gravity, well, that comes from a different culture, a different... These guys were into the esoteric arts, you know, alchemists, that kind of thing. And Germany was really a hotbed for this throughout European history, alchemy and the hermetic sciences.
Yeah.
You know, and
the Illuminati was begun by a German.
Yes. Yeah, in 1776.
Yes.
So there were Germans here who had fled Europe, and they liked, quite frankly, the wide open spaces and the lack of scrutiny that, you know, you could have. And so they went as far west as they could to be as far away from prying eyes. And this Del Shall says in his work, to get away from prying eyes. And they were able to experiment with their stuff. Now, they were doing this under the auspices of the loosely knit auspices of this mysterious NIMSA. And the difference in opinion came when NIMSA at some point made it clear that they wanted this technology to be applied to military uses, and the men in charge of the, for example, the Sonora Aero Club, the group in California, they did not want this technology applied for military purposes. They were vehemently opposed to that, and that's probably based on what Del Shall says in an analysis of the details were given in the history. That's probably where that was probably the beginning of the end of the Sonora Aero Club as we know it. That individual who was the head of the Sonora Aero Club, a man named Peter Menes, he died in an accident associated with a flight of one of these things. It might have been sabotage.
MENNIS.
Mm-hmm. And
not so, Dennis the Menace.
Yeah. And so this would be how this whole airship milieu brought its mystery, science, and technology to the United States. But they were not by any means the only people fooling around with this stuff over here. There were others. And Delschau says there were others. He only talks about the Sonora Aero Club. The idea is that he was probably, Dennis Crenshaw says this, that, and so do Pete Navarro, that Delschau kind of implies it and was probably sent to the United States by NHMSA as a representative of NHMSA to observe and report openly. I mean, the Sonora Aero Club knew he was the guy from Germany who was sent there and to observe their progress. And he stayed.
And you go into the possible way. And these are all, a lot of these things are, if you go through the book, you're saying, this guy was here, this makes sense. Who the hell, and given this, is it reasonable to assume?
Yeah, it's a lot of, it's a book of speculation. Right. And as you know, and those who've read my books know, I'm very upfront about, you know, I like writing these books. I like diving into these subjects because of the element of speculation. It's more interesting to me. This is the unwritten, unspoken little corners of history, the things that fall in the cracks. And, you know, we can't say for sure that any of this – we can't say for sure that the picture I painted is exactly accurate in every detail. Yeah. But
Delschau could have been a crazy old guy that just wrote a lot of this stuff. But there are bits and pieces of it that seem to make sense in light of other stuff you found out.
Yeah.
I don't 100% agree with you, but the thing is, it's speculation, so I don't have to.
Yeah.
And it takes me a while to get my brain. Every time I start reading one of your books, it's like, Walter is speculating. Let's see where he goes with it.
Exactly. And again, I'm clear about it.
This is what happened, and history is wrong, and this is absolutely true. It's like, no. Some of it, in fact, right at the end of the book, you said, I could be speculating on all this crap. But at the end of the book, you actually bring it back and say, look, there are incontrovertible things here.
Right.
Which I agreed with you about, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There are certain details and facts about this, folks, that are just plain fact, particularly when we get into the American group and Tillman and Dolbear. I find that to be a very interesting element. You know, we'll
I don't yet, and I'm going to have you convince
me. But let's go down your list of questions because
– Well, see, if I go down the list of questions, it's going to screw up our – this is something I've learned over many years of doing this stupid thing. Is that if I go down a list of questions, like some radio shows, it completely breaks the conversation.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I have lots of questions already gone out of order on some of them.
Okay. Well, just as long as we're covering what you felt was worth
asking. You know, I would read and then I'd get to certain places like, this seems important, like to talk about it on the show. One of them was, what sort of information was lost when the Library of Alexandria was burned?
Well, you know,
and why is that important? And where did that information go? That was a fascinating part of the book.
Well, that's been that's an age old question.
Yeah,
and
from Walter's point of view,
from my point of view is I'm personally convinced that civilization goes in a repeating pattern.
Cyclical.
It's cyclical. Advanced technology comes and goes, either depending upon geophysical cataclysms or socio-political cataclysms, whatever, you name it. Combination of both. There has been advanced technology, human civilization technology in the past. And there is now. Ours will go away and be somewhat forgotten, and another will replace it. Or when this planet finally dies and we're off on another planet, you know, whatever, on and on so forth.
Yeah.
So I think that with the Library of Alexandria, anybody who knows what the Library of Alexandria was, it was basically the sum collection of, you know, human knowledge at that time.
Yeah, at least Western and some Eastern.
Yeah.
As much as they could get.
And there's been theories that, you know, speaking of socio-political cataclysms, religious fanatics were stirred up to destroy the library because the people running it or the information in it were inconvenient to leaders at the time.
Yeah.
We can thank, Muslim and Christian fanatics for destroying the Library of Alexandria a couple of times. Well, there are theories that the Templars came into possession of a big chunk of the hidden information that had been saved when they went on the Crusades. And there's argument that they actually went there looking for that, that they weren't there to be Crusaders.
Yeah, or it was an excuse.
Yeah. Now, some of it was known to have ended up in this. I'd have to open the book. I'm working on another book right now, so I apologize for not having be able to pull specific names and titles out of this book
here. Some of it ended up in
Constantinople.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in Constantinople, and as Joseph Farrell has written, and you know, you can read in my books, the Fourth Crusade was likely more about getting their hands on that knowledge in Constantinople than it was to go to the Middle East, because on the way to the Middle East, they just decided to stop there and sack Constantinople. And one of the places they sacked was the repository. It has a big highfalutin name. It's in the book, but it was well known in ancient times. In fact, there were three places in ancient times: the Library of Alexandria, this place in Constantinople, I think like some royal depository or royal whatever, and then there was one in the Middle East, I think.
I thought you said there was one in Venice, too.
Well, eventually, the stuff ended up in Venice.
Okay, well, yeah.
Because
well,
the Venetian Doge Venetian, was part of
yeah, the Venetian yeah, rise they, to power was more like the 1400s, not when the Crusades were going on.
Well, the Fourth Crusade was at the hands of the Doge from Venice.
Oh, right? Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's right. Joseph, if you're listening and I'm wrong, feel free to correct me.
Yeah, he's at home jumping up and down and beating on the wall and going, you idiot!
Walter! How many times? But so then, you know, it's in the Templar hands, and of course, that's really a big bargaining chip of power for them because what they learned of this ancient knowledge. And then it ends up in the hands of mystery schools and the mystery lodges and such, Freemasonry among them. And, you know, pretty much people are familiar with that basic story. They know that then that's the kind of information that gets in the hands of hermetic scientists.
Right.
And that included Germany, because one of the main beneficiaries of that Fourth Crusade, big time, was the Teutonic Knights of Germany. And
Teutonic?
Teutonic, yeah. I don't know. The Teutonic Knights of Germany, and they were very instrumental in the whole, you know, involvement with pushing for a German culture and that kind of thing. And they, by virtue of being involved with that Fourth Crusade, they were the beneficiary or inherited some of what was sacked from Constantinople. So therefore, that's the line you can trace to the German mystics and hermetic scientists of later centuries and alchemists getting their hands on this information. Right. And then, of course, as the West opened up further and they came to the Americas, you know,
okay, well,
some of those guys end up here.
In your view, did some of this include technology that had to do with NIMSA stuff?
With
human flight?
Yes, it's very possible. It's very controversial, the whole subject of the ancient Hindu Vimana.
Yes.
Okay. There is an argument that one of the sources, which I won't even begin to pronounce, it's a double S word, the Sama something Sama, Sidri something. And I apologize to any Indian readers out there. I don't have it memorized, and I'd have to open it to the book. But anyway, this source is not as ancient as some writers cite it as being, and it's one of the main sources that people get the whole Mercury Vortex Engine Flying Vimana, a lot of it from. However, it is still in itself, even though that particular document is not old, it does draw from older texts and lore and things like that. So, you know, there's other sources you can draw, you know, alleged flying technology of the past.
When you hit the table, it goes through to the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
So, commonly we've heard of the flying vimanas of ancient India and the Mercury vortex engine, which has to do with heating mercury and rotation and spin.
Which most people know from the Nazi bell.
The bell, yeah. This is the same basic technology that allegedly went into the Nazi bell. So we're talking about that kind of stuff.
And if you don't know what that is, we're not going to go into that right now. I think right after you talked about some of that, you showed some illustrations of ancient petroglyphs and things like that, and how they look. You said they look like plasma charges.
Well, that's okay.
Well, somebody else did, but you used it.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I'd like to. Every time I talk about this stuff, and I do it in the book, every time I talk about this stuff anywhere, I like to remind the readers or inform the listeners. I'm not the first guy to ever talk about Delshow. I'm not the first guy to talk about a lot of these things. I really stand on the shoulders of Dennis Crenshaw, Pete Navarro, Michael Busby, Theo Pimans, Stephen Romano, and Tim Swartz and Sean Castile. I mean, these guys have all ventured into this.
Even Bill Moore to some extent.
Yeah, you know, Bill Moore. These people have all ventured into this Delshow territory and this NIMSA airship mystery stuff.
Right. Dennis Stacy, I think, did a little bit.
Yeah, for me, I was reading all this stuff, and what started emerging for me was what I wrote in Origin. And then, you know, coupled with further research that I did. So going back to
the plasma field question.
Which
I looked at, I was like, well, I guess. I mean, but what's your explanation of it?
And
what is it first?
Well, first of all, what it is what you see in ancient art depiction of the gods and their powers. You see shapes and images that are almost identical to plasma discharge. Well, somewhat, it looks identical. Yeah. You know, the source I found, Joseph Farrell talks about this too in a couple of his books, and it's kind of astonishing. And basically the assumption, which I think there's something to it, is that the ancients had access to more advanced technological knowledge, of course, than is assumed and presumed for them. And this is where they got these, you know, what we call these so-called religious symbols and imagery. Basically, what they were doing was documenting, you know, they were seeing these plasma discharges somewhere, somehow. And so they incorporated them, embedded them into, you know, their mythologies, because they couldn't think of, you know, a better explanation. Or if they knew the explanation, they embedded them in mythology on purpose so that the profane wouldn't get it. All they would see is mysticism and religion, but the enlightened would totally get what was really, you know, being conveyed. And I think there was some of that going on.
Did the guy whose pictures you have in there, the guy from Los Alamos, did he ever see these petroglyphs or say anything about it?
Well, I think he's the one that talks about it and presented it, that Joseph presents his stuff.
Oh, okay, okay.
We're talking about ancient Assyria, you know, ancient Babylonian things, folks. Okay, well, it goes way back.
And some other things, too.
Yeah. Oh, and Native American stuff, you know, as well. So, you know, this, again, is just one of the many little points that I and others, many others, have presented to say, hey, here's some evidence that there was a more advanced technological awareness back in ancient times.
What did the guy from Los Alamos say when he noticed the similarity between his plasma discharge photographs and ancient artwork, petroglyphs, and symbols?
Pretty much the same thing that I just said. Okay, something's going on in the remote past that, you know.
Because you look at them and you're like, it looks really damn similar.
Yeah.
As if
Some of them are exact.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not even similar. They're exact.
It's more than similar, in particularly the cases I present. And
To the point at which you're thinking, well, I guess it could be just, you know, out of how many different shapes of plasma discharges are there? You know?
Right.
And at some point, they're going to match up with something.
Yeah, but when you look at the book, it's not like we're talking a circle, a square, and a diamond shape. They're, I mean, we're talking specific little doodads and... you know.
I'd like to find the source for that and find out. It's like, how did he make these plasmids? Were they just random or what?
Right.
Or, you know, is it based on a harmonic that he was applying, or is it based on whatever is discharging the thing? Is it based on what kind of medium that the discharge is going into? Just stuff like
that. You know, and if I ever found out that the guy, you know, it's been proven that the guy faked all this stuff and you know, jimmied it this way, I would, you know, remove it from a future edition of the book as evidence. Because, you know, when you're doing these kinds of things, it would take you, you know, 5 or 10 years to finish a book if you carried out a full investigation, you know, that.
Yeah, I mean, on every source. Yeah, there's got to be a deadline.
Yeah, a point where you say, look, this is what this guy says.
Right.
So
Walter knows better than me. He's put out far more books at this point. Yeah. You're going to turn into Nick's twin here.
I'm trying to catch up with Nick.
Yeah.
I don't think I will.
But my last one was 10 years ago, Walter. Pathetic.
Ah, but your new one will make up for that.
I hope so. Are you coming out to Texas? Or
I'm not able to do that. And then I've since committed to something else for a family member. So
you butthole.
Yeah.
You went through a lot of other things in the book, and I once we get to an end of a thing, if I can't think of something, anything else, I'll do what I normally do, just jump to the other question.
Mm-hmm.
Very fascinating thing. What was the Angelic Society?
The Angelic Society is that
group. What did they do?
Well, it's that group. That's just it. What do they do? As far as we suspect, they select certain talented individuals to reveal knowledge in creative ways. One of the most famous, allegedly, having been Jules Verne. You know, there's been much speculation that Verne was being fed information about the technology that he wrote about.
And from where?
The Angelic Society.
Where do they get the information?
Well, that's just it. It's one of those alleged organizations that would be one of these secret, you know, hermetic.
Oh, so there's not
society.
Like a thing saying, here is the doctrine and incorporation papers Angelic Society.
Uh-uh. No, it's a theory.
Does anybody ever refer to it in their own writing or?
I didn't go that far. I just, and it's really just a mention in my book. That's you know. And,
yeah, but it was a fascinating idea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very interesting.
Because you pointed out that Jules Verne, you know, a lot of 20th century scientists said, well, you know, I read Jules Verne and I thought maybe this thing could be done.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, people watch Star Trek. It's like, oh, well, we got those now. It's right here.
And there was so much of it that Jules Verne specifically, you know, put out there that's one of the reasons why people think that he was being fed stuff.
I read an article by Joe McMonagle years ago, and the title of the article was something like, was Jules Verne a remote viewer?
What did McMonagle think about that?
Huh?
Did McMonagle?
He thought there was compelling evidence that he was so damned accurate that he somehow, not by being a remote viewer and going, what's going to happen in 100 years? But somehow he had the ability to unhook from time and see some of this stuff.
He's probably a natural at it. It came obliquely.
Right,
you know?
Right. Because some people are so, like, you know, what's the guy that wrote the book about the Titan and the Titanic?
Oh, yeah.
How similar that was.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
That's very weird. Well, it reminds me of Jeff Harvey, the guy that sent me the materials and taught me remote viewing, who passed away last summer.
Uh-oh.
And I remember that when he was training me, there was 11 or 12 steps in the process.
12 steps?
12 steps of the process. Yeah, imagine that. And I was having really great results. You remember that I was telling you about that. It astonished me what kind of results I was getting. But I was repeatedly, by the time I got through step 4, I felt the remaining 8 steps were superfluous. They weren't needed. And I remember I aggravated him one day, really, really made him mad, cranked him up when I said, you know what, I really don't see any point after step 4. Well, for about 5 months later, we talk and he says, I was talking with the guy who designed the program that I gave you. I'm like, yeah, he said something interesting to me just the other day. I'm like, yeah, what's that? He goes, well, he said he realized that after step four, the rest of it's not necessary. He says, you know, at the time, you were,
have a four-step program. Nobody's going to believe in that.
No, but he was saying, no, you're the student. I'm the trainer. You know, and he told me this himself, you know, and he's probably laughing about it now on the other side. But,
those last 8 steps were probably details, right?
They're just details, a lot of repetition. And basically by the time you'd get to step four in this particular process, you've carried it out as far as you're going to. But, Jules Verne might have been just a very natural remote viewer.
I went through 2 or 3 levels of, esoteric mystery school type thing. And when I got to the second or third step, I didn't sign up again.
Yeah.
I didn't go back. I didn't pay my dues for the next year, which was a pathetic amount. It wasn't, they weren't out to make money. It was the builders of the Adytum here in LA.
Okay.
And you get to points like, oh, okay. I'm doing what I want now. The thing that I was going to use this for to get myself out of my own way, it seems to be working, so I don't need it now.
Yeah.
Which is, when they said that thing about the subgenius church is a step after it, but don't take that step. Ivan Stang said, I was like, what is that step? Leaving the church? And he completely ignored me. He heard me. I was standing right next to him when he said, when I said it. But, Anyway, we've gotten a bit off track. The other thing is I have a book called The Frankenstein Diaries.
Okay.
And for what it is it purports to be, even though, everybody knows it's fictitious. It doesn't say so in the book. It said these diaries were found in the Castle Frankenstein that shows there was actually a guy trying to reanimate dead.
Okay.
And maybe he was successful, maybe he was not. It's got all these really weird drawings and things. And it's obviously fake. But you talked about Joseph Conrad Dippel.
Dippel, yes.
Yes. Why is he important to your story? Who was, would you say, born in the Castle Frankenstein? There is a Castle Frankenstein.
Yeah, he was probably the model for Percy Shelley. Yep. Yes, you heard me say it. Percy Shelley, to write Frankenstein. Mary Shelley did not write Frankenstein.
Yes, I have heard this.
I am convinced, and a student of the great Scott DeHart, who wrote the book on this, when Percy Shelley was, he was probably inspired by this Dippel guy because Dippel was doing all this crazy.
When was this?
Oh, you would ask me that.
Sorry.
It's in
You don't have an index, do you?
18th, no. 18th century.
What? Why didn't you take 2 months and look out an index?
Look, I got page numbers in the damn thing. That's what you get. Look, it's printed and there's page numbers. Dippel was, I think, was 18th century, maybe 17th century, somewhere along there.
Yeah.
And, he had this reputation.
Not too much before Shelley.
Not too much before Shelley.
Yeah. 100 or 200 years.
I mean, he would have been quite, his life and what he did was quite well known because he was controversial and scandalous and the stuff he was doing. He was doing attempting to do all those things Frankenstein did, reanimate this, galvanize that. It's in the book.
And how's that relevant to the story, though?
To
your story?
Well, in the book...
I can't remember how it's relevant, but it's like, this is cool stuff.
In the book, it's one of those things where I'm trying to establish the fact that these Germans were part of a tradition of the Hermetic sciences and the esoteric alchemical arts. And, Dippel was just one of many Germans that I think would have been either among the founders of or the guys who motivated the founders of the mysterious Nimza. In other words, whoever the mysterious Nimza was, they were the beneficiaries of the knowledge of men like Dippel and the other German alchemists who were the beneficiary of the, of what the Teutonic Knights brought back.
Right.
And that goes back to the Library of Alexandria and on and so forth.
So
I'm threading the needle with, pointing out Dippel and
So far we have ancient knowledge was passed to taken by the Teutonic Knights, which was distributed amongst German hermeticists, scientists, or whatever they were called at that time.
Uh-huh.
And that information went along with some German immigrants who came to the Western United States, according to Charles Delshow, A. Delshow, and formed this group, the Sonora Aero Club, which supposedly made
flying machines
machines in the
1850s.
Okay. Yeah. There was another guy who you bring up who was making flying machines in the 1850s.
Solomon Andrews.
Yes.
Dr. Solomon Andrews, who actually contacted during the war in the following decade, Solomon Andrews contacted Abraham Lincoln directly and explained to him that he had this flying machine. It was not a balloon. And Lincoln said, wow, I definitely want my people to take a look at this. So he gave a demonstration for Edwin Stanton's War Department, some military officials, and local newspapermen in Washington, D.C. There were several witnesses watching this thing called the Aeron, A-E-R-O-N, fly. And it was maneuverable. And again, it was not a balloon. Here's the thing, and I emphasize this in the book. These people knew the difference between a balloon, a Montgolfier Brothers, you know, balloon, and, you know, these airships.
What it looked like if it wasn't a balloon?
Oh, it was three cigar-shaped. These hulls, three cigar-shaped aeroforms, connected together with a gondola underneath. Gondola, for lack of a better, you know.
Yes. How do we know it wasn't filled with some sort of like hydrogen or something?
Well,
it was way too heavy to lift up.
Yeah, that's the thing. There was gas involved,
right?
But exactly, this thing, you know, was heavier than air, you know, vehicle, and he demonstrated this. It was very highly maneuverable, but we are told, and Michael Busby presents the really great details about this. He's the first writer to put this out there in his book, Solving the 1897 Airship Mystery. Andrews is told by Edwin Stanton that's like, nah, you know, we're going to win this war soon. The war is almost over, blah, blah, blah. We don't need this. Thank you. No, thank you. Well, I argue that that's bullshit. And I argue and point out in the book that I think they darn well were interested in the technology, war or not. I think that they contracted Andrews, and after the war, this mysterious Aeron technology of Solomon Andrews became America's first black project.
What? I said, what?
Yeah, I think...
Please elaborate, Walter.
I propose that this flying Aeron machine of Dr. Solomon Andrews, the technology, the development of it, became America's first black project post-Civil War. It was a black project because at the end of the war, all the resources were focused on Reconstruction, and the public would have went apeshit if they had heard that, you know, wait a minute, we're all recovering from this war and you want to put resources into this wacky flying machine thing. No, this ain't going to fly. No pun intended.
Yeah.
So therefore that's why it would have been a black project. Let's keep it secret, guys. Well, I think also because the government's resources were severely limited during this Reconstruction era, that's why they brought in, you know, guys from private industry. You know, the guys who could, you know, bring the resources and the know-how to do this thing. And they started developing this Aeron technology. I propose in the book that the development began in the late 1860s and continued on advancing through the years and through the technology itself into the 1890s, and that was the source of the 1890s airship mystery sightings in the United States.
Not the Sonora Air Club people?
No, the Sonora. We're talking about a knowledge of the same basic technology.
Oh, okay.
Certainly. There might have been some of the Sonora Aero Club guys involved in this, and very specifically, those enigmatic Wilsons.
Yes.
Because the mysterious Wilsons I go into in this book, I think more than any of my others, there was a Wilson in the Sonora Aero Club, Josh
Wilson?
Yes. There were two Wilsons identified by name and seen by, encountered by witnesses in the 1890s mystery.
Walter, why is this name important and how did you hear about it and a little bit of context for it? Because I had to get the context by reading the book. Like, oh, yeah, I remember him talking about this.
Yeah.
This name and this legendary person. And,
Wilson is, well, the fun.
And more than just a fairly normal name.
The fun dramatic telling of it is in 2004, I was at one of David Childress's AUP, what is it, Ancient Technology Modern Secrets conferences.
Yes.
And that's where I met Joseph Farrell. And one evening late.
Oh, it's Sedona, right?
No. This was in Kempton.
Oh, okay, Kempton, okay.
One late Saturday night. In the clubhouse, there was just myself and Joseph Farrell and the late Dorothy Murdoch, also known as Acharya.
Yeah,
she was. It was us three, or we three, and we were telling spooky, strange stories, and I happened.
Did you drink all your cider?
Nope.
I was hoping you like it.
I happened to mention it. I asked Joseph. I said, "You ever heard of a guy named Wilson?" And Joseph looked at me and
Anton Wilson?
Got that look like, egads, you've said that name. Yeah. And, you know, we started comparing notes. I told him why it came up for me and why I was asking. And then he told me, you know, a little bit what he knew. And basically, Wilson is this character that turns up in UFO lore. Not everybody has heard about him. In fact, there was a time when, you know, I tell the story about when Joseph and I first talked about him, when we first met, there was a time when Wilson would only come up in hushed whispers among few people who had heard of him.
Because the way you talk about him, he almost sounds like a span over about 150 years, almost a Count St. Germain type.
Which is why the evidence in my book I present that there's this multi-generational tradition handed down through this Wilson family of this arcane knowledge. You know, I was told by my mentor that Wilson is the most brilliant man alive that you've never heard of. And, you know, he has this connection allegedly to, you know, the development of flying saucer technology in the 40s in World War II. One author, W.A. Harbinson, in his books, Project Saucer series, he casts Wilson as the guy who was working with the Nazi scientists in developing their Hanabo flying saucer. But of course, he's doing it for his own. He's using them to advance the technology and such. And you know, what's interesting about this is at this time, I had not heard of the Wilsons connected with the Sonora Aero Club. I had not heard of the, you know, the Wilsons connected with the 1890s airship mystery. I learned about that subsequently to this conversation in 2004. And it just kind of blew my mind because it was like, well, wait a minute. Okay, here we go. Here's a source for this Wilson thing. And it's not all just Del Shaw. You know, it's the newspaper accounts of the 1890s. So I present in the book Origin, I present the thread of the Wilsons. There's some interesting details in the book on them and, you know, which Wilson is which, so to speak. I have a personal connection to this lore through my dad, his time in the Air Force, which I've discussed on this show at other times, and I've written about, and Mac Tonies has written about more than once, and Nick Redfern.
What did these Wilsons do? Who is this Wilson?
They were instrumental in designing and building and operating these airships from the Sonora Aero Club on through the 1890s mystery and to anti-gravity technology that my dad claims he witnessed out here in the Mojave Desert in the late 1950s. Being operated by two Wilsons.
Right.
The Wilson, the younger, being the mysterious one, Joseph and
so
I.
So Del Shaw actually refers to a Wilson.
Yeah, Del Shaw talks about Tosh Wilson being a member of the Sonora Aero Club.
Okay.
And again, the newspaper accounts talk about two Wilsons, Hiram and Willard, of the 1890s mystery.
Right.
Airship reports.
So. And they all seem, well, not all, but some of them seem to have the same technology available to them, which deals with vibrational.
Well, with resonance and there, you know, there's the sound vibrational resonance. There's also the chemical, the spin, the rotation, basically rudimentary, the same technology that went into the Nazi bell, but a more rudimentary form. In fact, I have the chart in the book.
Oh, you mean at the end there?
Yeah, that
I was going to wait till the end to get to the end.
Yeah, we'll discuss that later, I do have a chart.
The whole time in here, I'm going, well, how do you know it? How does this hook up and all that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of my main questions is, you sure rely on Delshow a lot.
That's all we have.
Does anybody else, that's one of my questions actually, is has anybody else sort of followed some of the same threads that you have? Have Navarro or... who are the other people? I can't remember. You mentioned quite a few people.
Yeah, I've been in communication. I exchanged emails with Pete Navarro.
Because he's the one that...
Stephen Romano put me in touch with Pete Navarro, and that was wonderful to be able to communicate.
Navarro was the second...
Pete Navarro was the guy who... Fred Washington was the man who owned the junk shop in Texas, who came into possession of the Delshow material, pulled it out of the trash. Some college kids were doing a project, you know, an exhibition, an exhibit. Okay, there's the word.
Yes.
An exhibit for a thing on the story of human flight.
Yeah, this was in Texas.
This is in Texas. And so they got Fred Washington to let them have a few of these. And that's how the Demonils, I think I'm pronouncing that right, the Demonils, they saw this and got their hands on some of the drawings. Well, Pete Navarro in 1971, I think it was, he's at the junk shop and he sees these things and he buys as many as he can afford.
Right.
And he actually came out to California, went up to Sonora, you know, did the thing I did and Bill Moore did that he told us about, where you go there, you look in cemeteries, you talk to locals and such. And
Bill didn't find anything, he said, but Bill, you said you did. Have you talked to him about it?
Okay, here's two things. Either Bill didn't look hard enough, or Bill's just as slick as we know he is, and ain't talking because,
he's never mentioned it again.
I got a local phone book, and I found three or four names in there that...
That Delshow mentioned.
Yeah. You know?
German names?
Yeah. And, I on my last trip there...
Did you follow up with any of these people?
I found others. Not yet. Okay. I've been busy writing other books, as you know. Yeah. But, you know, I've made two trips up there, and I've come away with, you know, leads to follow up on. So it's there. and even once I got to look at when Stephen Romano graciously sent me a copy of his amazing book, this Romano book, you guys, if you're interested in Delshow, you got to see this thing. Get your hands on a copy. It's worth it. It's a large coffee table type, large format book with colored plates.
$50-$80 book or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. It's like 2 inches thick, and it's the biggest collection in one book of Delshow's actual art and drawings that we're talking about.
So it's published through the gallery, right?
Yeah, the Romano Gallery. And
in New York.
You know, Stephen sent me that book, and there's sketches in there that were in Delshow's diaries, you know, that he published in his book. There's some stuff that's not published. But, you know, he published what he felt was essential. And the sketches in there, I went up there. My last trip, Sesheri came down, joined me. And we went nosing around, poking around. And we found what we're pretty sure we found a spot that Delshow actually illustrated in his diary in Colombia.
Which is near Sonora.
Which is next to Sonora. Yeah. The Sonora Aero Club was actually headquartered in and more active in the Columbia area. Yeah, you know, but they called themselves
This is Columbia, California. Yeah. Another
gold country,
right next to Sonora in the foothills of the Sierras.
Yeah, west of Yosemite. Yeah. You know. And where were we at? I lost me.
You were talking about Romano and all the manuscripts.
All the people. You said, you know, has anyone else followed up on this stuff? Yeah. So Navarro and Moore and myself, Olaf Phillips has been out there. Yeah, in fact, he and I are talking about going together to explore some other ancient mysteries in the general area up there. And so, you know, the people I know of that have looked into this, they do find, you know, interesting threads to pull. But, you know, these guys covered their tracks pretty well.
Right. I Radio Mysterio super fan and host of Paramania, Steve Ray. He writes, a question you could ask Walter.
I guess I could.
Regarding the subject of books that come true later, like the novel about the Titan.
Yes.
One theory is that the authors are remote viewers who see the future. But another popular theory involves a revelation of the method, which says that evil elites are honor-bound to announce great crimes in advance.
Oh, sure. A revelation of method is a very strong possibility.
Yeah?
I think.
Does Walter have an opinion either way about this?
I just expressed it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I do think that...
Elaborate, please.
Revelation of method could very well, you know, be part of this. This thing that, you know, when we're talking about Jules Verne and we're talking about the guy who wrote The Titan. For those who aren't familiar with it, Google it. This novel, The Titan, was written in the 1890s. It describes a ship called The Titan, a cruise ship called The Titan, which is virtually identical to the Titanic, which, of course, 15, 20 years later.
Futility or the wreck of the Titan.
Yeah. And it hits an iceberg, I think. I mean, the whole thing.
By Morgan Robertson, 1898.
Yeah, Morgan Robertson. Boy, that really sounds like a pseudonym to me.
Yes, it does. Features the fictional ocean liner Titan, which sinks in the North Atlantic after striking an iceberg. Has been noted to be very similar to the real-life passenger ship Titanic, which sank 14 years later. The following the wreck, the novel was reissued with some changes, particularly in the ship's gross tonnage. Yeah.
Wait, what changes?
Did somebody gross make, tonnage.
So did somebody... You're not saying somebody changed the book to match the Titanic, are you?
It doesn't say it's... It just says it was reissued with some changes.
Hmm.
It doesn't say anything about what was changed. Following the Titanic sinking, some people credited Robertson with clairvoyance. Robertson denied this, claiming the similarities were explained by his extensive knowledge of shipbuilding and maritime trends.
Yeah, but there's still a predictive quality to that.
Yeah.
You know, just you, if you take the Swami hat and the crystal ball away, you know, just because you replace it with expertise and technical know-how,
yeah,
that's still extraordinary.
Right.
Because, you know, this is what guys like Steve Jobs and them who, you know,
right,
saw where things were going. You know, to me, that's just as extraordinary as what, you know, as Hocus Pocus.
I was trying to see if anybody's commenting on that.
But I don't like, even though I acknowledge that that's just as extraordinary as Hocus Pocus, I think it's foolish when, you know, the pure tech science weenies dismiss Hocus Pocus.
Right. Or what we refer to as...
Exactly. What we refer to as Hocus Pocus because we don't have any other explanation for it yet.
Yet. Yes. I like yet. How about these two airship guys? Tillman and Dolbear.
Amos Dolbear. First,
explain who these people are, and then I'll get to my, wouldn't have they just been some famous scientist people that whoever wrote it might have referred to? But please go explain who they are and how they appeared in one of these airship stories.
Yeah, in the 1890s Airship Mysteries, again, you can read the original accounts in the excellent book by Michael Busby titled Solving the 1897 Airship Mystery.
It is exhaustive, that book.
It's, yeah, that's Busby has written the best book on the airship mystery. Sorry, all you folks that think there's an ET answer to it. You're wrong, okay? You're wrong. The 1890s Airship Mystery was a human phenomenon. It had nothing to do with ETs.
I've never met anybody that thought it was an ET thing. I did not even know there was a school of that until I read your book. It's like, people think that?
Yeah, people think that. It's out there, let's say, in other media sources.
Okay.
Yeah, I have heard it more than once. I think most people who look at it agree with us. You know, they say, yeah, that is kind of nutty to think it's ET. But anyway, here's the thing. Some of the newspaper accounts refer to one of these now we're in the 1890s now. These are the cigar-shaped things that sound like they resemble Zeppelins, but they're not.
They're too small to be.
Yeah, one of these landed, and two very human men climbed out of the thing and approached the witnesses and identified themselves. One was Samuel Tillman, and the other one was Amos Dolbear. Well, they told the witnesses who they were, what they were doing. They built this airship. They'd come from such and such city and had made another city in a ridiculously, for the time, fast, you know, rate of speed. And they even told them where they were, you know, they were going to continue on, you know, farther, you know, down the line there. And here's the interesting thing about this. Not only were they described as very human beings, and they even gave human names. And by the way, you can look up Tillman, look up Colonel Samuel E. Tillman on your computers right now. Google him. He's a very – there's pictures of him. Well-documented guy, Army officer. At one time, later in his life, he was the commandant of West Point during World War I. He was a professor of chemistry. I'm stomping my foot. At West Point for many years. His assignment as a young Army officer was survey and exploration. And here we have him, according to witnesses, being one of the guys that steps off an airship in the 1890s. Now, Samuel Tillman was not a rock and roll star, folks. You know, he wasn't like Mark Twain. He wasn't like...
There we go.
There it is.
Somebody just posted something on UFO updates and said that...
Where's the siren?
Yeah. No. Today they said... he's just like, this is a very good show. You should all listen to it. Greg doesn't get enough credit, which was a really nice thing for somebody to say.
Oh, cool.
But he said... I got to see what he said. It's actually pretty funny. He did say something about the siren is kind of a theme on the show. The frequent sirens.
I think it's you like, need to make
not that frequent.
I think you need to incorporate a siren into the intro.
You're right.
I mean, duh! All this time we've never. I don't know. Maybe you thought of it, but it just crossed my mind. Maybe I ought to put the siren in the intro. The siren pops on. It's time for.
Yep.
So yeah. So you have Samuel Tillman, and I go into what my speculations are regarding Tillman. You know, he was connected. He was in the Cosmo Club, which the Cosmo Club was a group of explorers that was involved with they were part of the group that founded the National Geographic magazine and were part of the Explorers Club, the legendary Explorers Club. So here was a guy who was in the same circles that, say, Sir Richard Francis Burton, you know, moved in. And those of you who have read my book, The Lost Expedition of Sir Richard Francis Burton, will know why that's significant, because I show where Burton was likely tied to these hermetic organizations. In my current book that I'm writing, which I won't reveal the full identity of.
Fine, that's fine.
I'm looking at an American group very similar to the Royal Society, which is called the... I'm doing a brain dump.
I'm doing those all the time now, Walter, and you're only a month, 3 weeks older than me.
The American, I'll be darned, the American Philosophical Society, I think it was founded by, one of the founders was Benjamin Franklin, it was based in Philadelphia. It was very much an American Royal Society.
Right.
Okay. And it's part of my investigation on my Secret Missions 3 book. Well, I'm finding where if there were some hermetic things going on in this, you know, this APS, guys like Tillman and other members of these Cosmo Club and, you know, the Explorers group probably, you know, would have been involved with when we look at the alleged Tillman connection to the airship mystery.
Yeah.
And the description of the technology in these 1890s airships has, you know, we talked earlier about resonance and vibration and spin.
Right.
And, you know, again, the rudimentary technology of the Bell.
Stuff.
Yeah, in relation to anti-gravity, which are a rudimentary form of the Bell, which brings me back to the chart. I might as well, basically, in my book Origin, I present, I provide a chart, and you can even see this in my talk at the breakaway, Secret Space Program Breakaway Civilization Conference that I spoke at in October in Texas. That's, you can find that online. You can see the chart if you don't have the book, but it's in the book.
Yeah.
Basically, I show the progression from the days of the Sonora Air Club in the 1850s to the airship mystery of the 1890s and then on up to the modern flying saucer. And essentially what we're talking about is the same technology, just at different stages. And I equate one of Delschau's 1850s Aeros to a Model T Ford. And then you go, you know, about 30-some years down the line to the 1890s, and I equate the 1890s airship, same technology, but it's like a 58 Buick compared to the
Model
T Ford.
What year do you have on the Buick in there? Because I said 58 Buick in my head about 5 seconds
ago. 1958 Buick.
Oh, well, then I remembered it.
Yeah. The modern UFO, which is the progression from the 1890s airship, in my opinion, is like a 1985 Porsche compared to the 58 Buick compared to the Model T.
Yeah.
So basically the chart is 1850s Aero to 1890s airship to modern UFO.
Okay. To be
Model
truthful,
T, 58 Buick,
that,
Porsche.
That did not amaze me near as much as the drawings.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, the drawings themselves. The chart is just, yes. Oh, yes. Thank you. Let's go to the Bell, shall we?
Yeah.
See, okay.
I can take the rest of the book sort of with a grain of salt. It's like, yeah, maybe. You know, what interested Walter in the first place? Why does he think this is important? And this was the important part of the book where I didn't go, yeah, you're right. But it's kind of like, okay, now I get why he's interested in this and all this speculation. Please explain.
I never knew this about the Delschau material until I got the Crenshaw book, and then Stephen Romano sent me the Gallery book. Dennis Crenshaw shows a bit of this in his book, and then in the Romano Gallery book, you can see it bigger and more detailed. And quite frankly, it made my jaw drop. And I remember it was one of those late nights. I had gone up to Joseph Farrell's and I said, you got to see this.
This is assuming you put some credence in the next couple of things that are in that list.
Here's the thing. This is a Delschau drawing of something that was done in the the technology used by this 1850 Sonora Aero Club. The Delschau drawing was probably circa 1890s. Okay.
It was his remembrance.
Yeah, he's remembering back. The drawing itself was done in the 1890s, and it is the spitting image of the Nazi Bell in its essentials.
Yeah, in the way that he shows the forces, the shape, and all that.
The shape,
stuff.
You know, the rotation, the central core, it's shaped like a bell.
Yes.
And in both my talk in Texas and in the book here, I present, you know, a graphic showing the Aero Club 1856 Bell, which Delschau referred to as a generator cone. So there's another, you know.
And this isn't one of like what everybody knows him for, these elaborate, beautiful drawings.
That's
of
right.
Things.
This is showing the engine, how it worked.
Yeah.
And this is like a schematic.
Yeah.
Okay. Now remember, he did this
so
in
either
the
18- he saw it or he's, it's a huge coincidence. Yeah. Or he's a remote viewer or something.
Exactly. So he draws this thing that is essentially the Bell in the 1890s. And then, of course, 25, 30 years later, we're told that the Nazis are developing this same exact thing.
Yeah. And you saw this after Joseph Farrell's book, after Nick Cook's book.
That's right.
After all this stuff.
After all this stuff. And, you know, there it is in Del Shall's own work. It's the bell, folks. It's the bell. What we think of as the bell. And, you know, yeah, and then,
Walter,
of course,
saved the best for last here. I mean, in the book, like I said, I was like, so. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. It, you know, here's the thing with my books. You can take each individual point and element that I present and you can say, I question it. But when you put it all together, it's a preponderance of evidence and elements that makes it harder to dismiss. I'm not going to say makes it easier for you to embrace and accept. What I am going to say with confidence is when you look at the whole of what I present in this book and others, it makes it legitimately harder to dismiss. And I'll take that, you know, with some folks, you know, I'll take the acknowledgement that's like, hey, I can't dismiss this. Because that's a beginning. That's a door opening. But now Joseph is the one who saw in the mysterious coded language of Del Shall a mathematical equation.
Oh, the thing that's on the...
Yes.
That thing that looks like a mathematical equation.
Yeah, it looks like a mathematical equation. But the only thing that had been... discerned or translated or speculated about it is that it was just the coded spelling for the acronym NIMSA, which, again, we're talking coded spelling within a coded spelling.
It doesn't even look like the word NIMSA.
It doesn't even look. It looks like a D or a shovel with an M, an equal sign, an X, and the, what is that, phi? Kind of a Greek phi. Well, when Joseph first looked at that, you know, his jaw dropped and he says, and I present...
The fact that it has an equal sign in the middle of it...
Yeah, it's kind of a giveaway. Well, you know, we're talking about this advanced technology. We're talking about all this mathematics. We're talking about, you know, possibly the bell and all this stuff. And, you know, it's like you got to ask yourself, this equation-looking thing...
Do you mind when I post the show that I either put that... Oh, God, I'm going to sneeze. That...
bless you.
That either the thing with the bell in the drawing or that. Actually, the bell in the drawing would be, is it possible to just put this drawing up as that?
Do you need me to send it to you or can you pull it down out of the out of something?
I'll see if I can get it off the
I'll pull it off. I'll just send you the graphic.
Okay.
I'll send you the graphic.
Because if somebody sees that first, they go, okay, you know, I wish I'd seen that before I started reading the book. So I'm going, yeah. And then I get to the end, it's like, oh, I see why. I see where all the speculation comes from.
Oh, that's what I like to do. I like to just lure in the naysayers. This guy's an asshole. And then they read the last thing and they go, oh, shoot.
Well, does not mean that everything else you said in the book or even most of what you said in the book is true or even important.
Let's not say true. Let's say accurate.
Compelling.
Accurate. Or convincing of everyone.
Right.
Because when you use terms like true or false,
right.
In some people's minds, it's a connotation of you're making it up.
Yeah.
You know, and
I don't think you made any of this. Obviously, to me, you
didn't
make
this stuff up. I might conclude erroneously.
Yeah.
In where details are concerned, but I, you know, I think the general analysis is worthy.
I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that possibly that, what was the name of the guy?
Oliver Heaviside?
No.
Tillman?
Lincoln's Air Force.
Edwin Stanton?
No.
Oh, Solomon Andrews.
Yeah. You mentioned that you had the theory that maybe they were, that this technology was taken and basically tested like black projects out in the middle of nowhere somewhere where nobody would see it, at near military installations.
Yes.
Have you checked to see if there were airship sightings near military installations?
Well, yeah, when you look at the 1890s airship mystery.
Because there weren't near as many military bases
there
are now.
They were army forts.
Yeah.
And, these forts are located along the path that in the 1890s these airships were being seen. Remember, I tie in the airship technology to the world grid.
Right.
And, I argue that these airships were – I talk about this in Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora. I lay out that – I think the Earth energy grid had something to do with it. The airships would follow the world grid like ships follow currents on the sea.
Right.
Okay. And so
Oh, yeah. I didn't even write one of the questions, the Tesla radio thing. We'll get to that.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, absolutely. In the 1890s, when the reports were coming in, yeah, there were, you can, and I think I identify some that were, but I don't go too deep into that. That would be very intriguing to see if there were any, you know, heretofore unpublicized reports prior to the 1890s in those areas.
I know who you can ask.
Who?
Chris Albeck.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He wrote the book with Jacques Vallée.
And he has a group called Magonia Exchange, which you should probably join, because basically if you say, does anybody have any reports of strange objects seen in the sky near army forts in, from 1850 to 1890, and they will pull them up for you.
Okay. What's their ultimate do they have a presumption?
They have no ultimate anything. No.
Okay, good. So they leave that open?
Yeah. No, all they do is look stuff up.
Okay.
And if you're a researcher...
But do they have an inclination? Do they lean more towards ET? Do they lean more towards, you know...
They're all over the map, but when the thing is, I've been watching their group.
They're pretty objective in the data that they...
Yeah.
And the interaction.
Yeah. Okay. If you say, I'd like information on this, they find you all the information on that, and they don't say, and you're a stupid believer.
Or, why don't you believe?
Yeah. None of that. I mean, as far as I can tell, it's like, here's the information. Make of it what you will.
I'll check that out. We just dug out the information for you.
Yeah. I'm planning to use them for a couple little things I want to do.
I remember I looked at that.
They're just really helpful, friendly people that like to look stuff up.
Yeah. Okay. I'll check it out because there might be something. I found on the General Airship Mystery, the Busby book was just so full of the detail, you know, on all the sightings because, you know, he reprints the newspaper articles and such. Yeah. I'm going to be revisiting this again in the next book because there are reasons to suspect that the subject of the next book was associated.
Yes. Well, there is sort of – there's a theme – not a theme, but all your books have some little references to the other books.
Well, here's the thing. One does literally legitimately lead to the other.
Yeah, because you just keep going.
The Secret Missions book – Secret Missions 3, the one that I'm writing now, premise of it popped up during research on the Burton book. As I was doing research on the Burton book, the other individual who shall remain nameless popped up in relation to some things that I had no idea this person was affiliated with. And I go, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. So I noted that and set it aside. And the more I looked at it, I realized, oh, my God, here we go. You know, and which may also bring us back to At a Place.
Yeah.
So
Steve said he's pointing out that Steve Ray. Delschau's drawings were completely unknown until 1969, so they couldn't have influenced the Nazi design or anybody else doing research on it, for that matter.
Well, except if I'm correct.
Oh, I see what you mean.
See, my premise, NIMSA being behind the Sonora Aero Club, I also show, which we haven't talked about, I show the NIMSA connection and influence on the rise of the Nazis.
Right.
So if the Sonora Aero Club and the NIMSA guys were doing the Bell technology back in the 19th century, I argue in my book and present the details that that's how the Nazis got it in the first place.
Right.
In other words, folks, what the Sonora Aero Club was doing and what some of the 1890s airship group was doing, you know, the Sonora group, the German group, was doing it under the auspices of NIMSA, which I argue was a German group, and I show where it's possible, and in my opinion, probable, that the whole Nazi milieu, their science and technology now we're talking about, rose from an influence, direct and indirect, of the NIMSA. So what Steve brings up is a very good point, which I think further emphasizes and serves to prove my supposition that, there you go. That's right. Delschau's stuff wasn't known to the general public until the late 1960s. How did the Nazis learn about it then? NIMSA, there's your bridge connecting the Sonora Aero Club and the Nazis.
You hypothesize that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were sent to Argentina, possibly set up an airship base and look for evidence of ancient technology or knowledge.
No, that's not what I say.
No?
I say they were sent on, they took a deal from E.H. Harriman that was connected with the NIMSA. The deal was for them to set up a ranch that would serve as a base for NIMSA airships. And the NIMSA airship crews the NIMSA airship guys were the ones looking for the lost stuff, the old source and stuff. Butch and Sundance and Etta, their main part of the deal was to just establish the ranch and facilitate that as an airship base.
And
but Etta, being who I think she was,
right,
an undercover agent for Secret Service, she was collecting on and reporting on the German group activities, the NIMSA activities.
How did you come to hypothesize that that happened? And is there any outside evidence where they said, well, we were doing this? Where, I mean, I guess they wouldn't talk about it, but...
You mean the going to South America?
No, we know they went to South America.
No. You mean how did I hypothesize that it had... Okay, because we are told that... And I go into this in Empire of the Wheel.
I'm not going to argue that they went to South America. Yeah, That's where they supposedly died.
Supposedly. And I go into this in great detail in Empire of the Wheel, Two Friends from Sonora.
Yeah.
But essentially, history tells us that... they keep robbing the, E.A. Chairman's railroad. And, at one point, Butch expressed interest in getting amnesty. And so he went to Governor Wells of Utah to request amnesty. And Governor Wells told him, well, I can't grant that to you without you going to talk to E.A. Chairman, the
aggrieved party.
Yes. The owner and CEO of the Union Pacific.
I guess.
Yeah, Union Pacific Road. And we're told that Butch just suddenly decided, nah, I want to keep being a criminal. however, after this time that he expressed this to Governor Wells and he was told to go speak to Harriman, Butch's gang robs a Union Pacific train only one last time. And then after that robbery, the Tipton robbery, Tipton, Wyoming, suddenly, the gang that could never be caught, the gang that could do no wrong, this amazing gang, suddenly they could do nothing right. Suddenly, they're getting in shootouts, which they would never get into before. Suddenly, right, their guys are getting caught. Suddenly, the law is showing up before they get there. So, I argue that there was a source in the gang, and I explain why it would have been Harry Longabaugh, the Sundance Kid, and at a place. But what I also argue is that Butch did meet with Harriman, okay? And here's the interesting thing. E.H. Harriman's backer to buy the Union Pacific Railroad was bankers, German-born bankers, Kuhn Loeb. Okay, Kuhn Loeb is involved in the history of the Lehman Brothers and right, all those, American Express, all that. Anyway, Kuhn Loeb at one time physically owned all or like almost 70% of the physical railroad laid in the United States. They were the real rail barons, okay? When E.H. Harriman went to buy the Union Pacific Railroad, because it existed before he had it, he paid a ridiculous amount, far more than the value. And Kuhn Loeb were the ones who gave him the money. Now, when you look at E.H. Harriman, who he was and who his sons were, Averill and Bunny Harriman, who were friends with
Prescott Bush.
do your own math there. And Prescott Bush got into trouble for doing some banking for the Nazis.
Right.
I argue that, that kind of tipped me off to, okay, Harriman's backer was German bankers. And his sons get involved with, an American who's a Nazi banker. I argued, therefore, let's look at Harriman, making a deal with Butch and Sundance. It's like, okay, my master is essentially, we want to do some operations, our group down in South America. Here's the thing. You'll get amnesty. We'll give you the money. We'll grease the skids on the immigration. You go down to South America. Just set up a ranch. You keep your mouth shut. You'll be paid well, and you're going to let these guys do their thing. These NIMSA guys.
Yeah. Okay. There is a nice little piece of information in there about Sean Castile when he was doing journalism stuff before he got involved in UFO things and all that, interviewing J. Allen Hynek. Hynek was saying something about he had heard that Tesla either tried to or invented something that would Oh, that's you breathing.
Yes.
Invented something that flew that got him to Mars.
Yeah.
And that is, this is why he said that the part of the reason that the Navy, I guess it was, went to his storage unit right when he died and grabbed everything.
The legendary Journey to Mars.
Apart from the fact that he had a whole bunch of other stuff in there, yeah. Probably.
The legendary Journey to Mars, which Castile writes about, and Tim Swartz, I think, was yeah. part of that research. The legendary Journey to Mars in 1903,
yes.
which supposedly involved Tesla technology. Now, Tim says that Ken Thomas, no, not Ken, Jim Keith.
Yes.
That Jim Keith told him about the 1903 Journey to Mars.
Right.
And the reason Ken came up is because I'd love to ask Ken, if Jim, you know, hey, what did Jim ever mention the 1903 trip to Mars? Which is kind of interesting when you consider the mystery, you know, the alleged mystery of Jim Keith's untimely passing. You know, you kind of go, how soon after did he, you know, let's do a little time juxtaposition here.
Yeah.
But basically, the story goes that Tesla technology was used on an airship to journey to Mars, and that Tesla talked about receiving transmissions from somebody out there, which Tesla initially, or in one source, stated that it might have been from this airship crew that was lost. They never returned, according to the lore. And I do a fanciful little, you know, hey, let's speculate here.
This speculation. This was a fun one. It's like, wow, that'd make a great movie.
Okay, imagine that.
You know what a cool steampunky movie that would make?
Exactly. Yeah, well, a guy named Sacheri wrote a novel.
Yes, exactly.
Basically, that's called Wonder of the Worlds,
yes.
You know, and in which Mark Twain, Nikola Tesla, and a young Harry Houdini go to Mars on an airship in 1893.
Yeah.
You know, he was familiar with, you know, Castile's book at the time, and he said, well, what if these guys? Well, you know, this goes back to this story that Sean Castile writes about in his book, he and Tim, and you know, the story goes that there was this signal coming from Mars, and the airship followed it, and allegedly Tesla thought that – I think I got this right. Again, I'm working on another book, folks, so my mind's in that one. And Tesla or somebody thought that perhaps the signal worked like a tractor beam and pulled them into Mars the rest of the way. And
yes.
What if, I speculate, what if they got down there and they found that Mars is nothing like NASA tells us
the speculation I was talking about, but this was good too. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know.
I was talking about the radio signal stuff, but go ahead.
You know, what if let's leave what I'm talking about to the reader. What were you getting at? Which radio signal stuff?
You said that it's documented that Tesla said he heard strange signals.
Oh, yeah.
And some people say, well, there were signals from Mars or space or aliens or whatever.
Right.
And your idea was,
oh,
maybe it's not coming from Mars.
Oh.
Maybe it's signals between.
Okay. That's Jonathan Battisti.
Okay.
Who is, he has I met him at the 2014 Breakaway conference, and he was at the 2015 one. He's a friend of also a friend and reader of Joseph Farrell's. And Jonathan, I mean, this blew my mind when he told me about this. He said, hey, you know, what do you think about the idea that maybe the signals now I know what you're talking about.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, I went off on the wrong thing. What if instead of Martians or a lost Martian city, what if these transmissions were the coded communications of the airship group?
Because he said he heard these things in 1899 or?
Yeah, he heard them during the era of the airships. What if, you know, what if they were using, why not coded communications? It's logical. It makes perfect sense. And, you know, I hadn't, you know, ventured into the idea of communications yet with this stuff. So that's, Jonathan Battisti, that's his analysis And he's got a book in him that's going to be coming out eventually, and his ideas. He's going to be a name you're going to want to have him on here at some point when he gets his book out and his research out, because he's doing some, I won't even go into it, but he's doing some amazing stuff. But the radio communication and the lost ancient advanced technology city on Mars thing is fun, but I put Jonathan's
it seems a little more far-fetched than.
Yeah, I put Jonathan's idea in the book because I think it actually is a little bit more, no pun intended, down to earth.
Yes.
It really further emphasizes the possibility of what I'm proposing in my book. Tesla wasn't necessarily getting these things from Mars. He could have just been picking up literally coded transmissions between the 1890s mystery airships.
Right.
Indeed, absolutely. That could have been it.
We got like 10 or 15 minutes left. Sure. Do you want to use it up, or I got one more question.
Sure.
And it's not like a concluding question.
Have people been liking this show?
Yes. Okay, there's people.
Is it disconnected?
Steve is saying things.
Because this book is so full of stuff, it's hard.
It does exactly what most shows do. It starts out with like 20, 25 listeners, goes up to 30 or so, and then in the last half hour, it drops down.
Okay. I don't exactly like to bore people, as you know.
You're not boring people.
And I really hate to disappoint people. So
you're not boring people. I looked at it. This has gone from 18 to 22 or 23, and then there's some up here. And gone back down.
Okay, cool.
So it's like, people have to go to sleep. Some of the people are listening to us are on the East Coast. Yeah. So they're gonna wait till I post this in 2 or 3 weeks or some ridiculous amount of time. I will tell you what I was reading when we're not here, because I can't say it here.
Okay, well, you said you had one more question, or did you already get
it? No, I didn't do it. Were there any reports of bell-shaped airships that you've been able to...
bell-shaped airships. Yes. Now, remember, my book stops in the early 20th century.
Yeah,
but
no airships. And this is. Did anybody ever see one, or is it because the Nazi one apparently was just they were a proof of concept thing. And the way that Delschau drew it, he said this is the source of power.
Well, they're
not the shape of the airship.
There actually is one that's kind of belly shaped.
Really? Another question you can ask the Magonian Exchange people.
In Romano's book.
Okay.
One of the
No, I mean like a newspaper account or something. No. However much confidence you put in the newspaper.
You can put a little bit more confidence in those newspapers than dismissers like to. They like to just say, "Oh, it's all just a newspaper hoax." When you delve into this, that is just such naysayer bullshit, these guys.
Well, and you'd hate Abeck because he said that most of it.
No, most of them were not hoaxes. I'm sorry. I disagree with him on that. Most of them were not hoaxes. There were probably a few hoaxes, to generate circulation.
How did you find that out?
Well, by reading them, when you read them and you see what's said about them, the people that want to dismiss them as hoaxes, I hate to say it. I'm not saying this about Abeck. It's his book. He's done a thick book.
Well, his point was that
he's probably read them all. But some of these people who dismiss it, I think, have never read them.
Yes. He's read them.
Yeah, he's read them.
He's read them, and apparently he's checked up on some of the people in them. This is how he goes through in his books. Like, how do I check out that these reports about going back to 16-whatever or 15-whatever are true? I check... records. I check on people's names, where they lived.
Yeah,
where they lived.
I do that to the extent that I can. Yeah,
who they knew.
Sure.
If they knew the people that are in the, what was going on in that night? Did anybody else say anything? And also, what was going on in the sky that night, astronomically? Which you can't really.
That's weak.
Yeah, that's weak. But from his point of view, and I don't want to speak for him. From his point of view, he said, as far as I can tell, most of them were newspaper hoaxes.
I disagree.
Okay.
No, I disagree on the most of them. A few of them, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, were. The most of them?
I'd like to see a lively debate between you two at some point.
I don't debate.
Okay.
I don't get into that. That's passé.
Really? Even if somebody had some logical... And he's not a doctrinaire.
I say present it and get it out there. Yeah. And people... I let people decide for themselves.
You know what he's doing now is going through... I think this is in my show. He's going through all of Charles Fort's books and checking out every single thing in them to see how well it stands up to historical scrutiny.
Okay.
Really interesting to me. Not an attempt to say that Charles Fort was full of crap. Just, you know, if we look at this stuff, what
well, that's kind of what I did with Origin. That's why I, if you'll notice, I took Tillman and Dolbear.
Right.
You know, that Busby goes into it a little bit, but I took it a little farther. So right. I did do that, and Tillman and Dolbear stand up solid, as near as I can tell. And
as far as their backgrounds.
Yeah. I mean, these guys really existed. They were, you know, real guys. And particularly Tillman, I think, is important in this.
I wonder who wrote the story and what they knew about those two guys.
Yeah, well, there you go.
See, I don't know how famous those guys were.
They weren't at the time.
Yeah. And the one thing you say in there is, well, if the guy wrote the story and said they were the airship people, why didn't they get mad? It's like, well, maybe they never saw the damn story. People didn't communicate that well.
Wait, then. Why didn't who?
Tillman and Dolbear get mad when they saw that they referred to as either they never saw the story or they really were those people.
There you go. Bingo. That's what I think.
Okay.
You have to consider that the reason they didn't get pissed off was because the story didn't lie.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, it's interesting that up until a certain point, they weren't exactly being that secret about all this.
Right.
See, I argue that in the book I go into that at some point in the 1890s, early 1900s, okay, they were beginning to lean towards, we don't like the way some things are going.
You mean
the country.
Okay.
The country. They saw us going into the 20th century and becoming...
No, I mean they is...
Tillman, the American group, what I call the American group, the original Black Project, the Aaron guys.
Okay.
And then we have this story of 1903, airship going to Mars kind of thing. I speculate that perhaps there was some true turning point in 1903 where they discovered something, and that was when they made the decision... Screw this, we're breaking away.
And where'd they go?
They could have gone to Mars. Maybe, and this comes back to maybe what we're told about Mars is a bunch of BS. It's you can't live there, blah, blah, blah. Remember for years they've been telling us, oh, well, there's no water. And last year they admitted to running water.
Yeah.
Flowing water. I mean,
well, there were
on.
Pictures of it. Well, pictures of very recent flowing water.
Yeah, and you think that they... that. I don't buy that NASA just learned about that in the last few years with the latest rover. Bullshit. You know, I think that even if the 1903 thing is nonsense, they've known, just like they know more about what's on the moon. Like, you know, these people that argue we didn't go to the moon, I'm not wasting my time with that ridiculous discussion.
Yeah.
I like the idea that they didn't tell us everything they saw and found up there.
And that, and my favorite idea of yours, which, for some reason resonates with me very much, is Apollo 11 was the first. Yeah, it was the main show.
It was the dog and pony
after
show.
A few dress rehearsals.
Or at least one where we knew we could do it. Yeah.
Dress rehearsals, meaning they went through the whole thing.
Yeah, that's my personal speculation that we landed men on the moon to make damn sure we could do it and bring them back alive. Now look, before some patriotic Americans get all kerfluffled about this, or fans of Buzz, because I know there's some fans of Buzz that are just, they're like girls over the Beatles. Jesus Christ. here's the thing. They get all worked up. I'm not saying Apollo 11, I'm not saying any other moon mission was not ballsy as hell and didn't require nuts of steel.
Yeah.
It did. Okay, yeah. Those guys are friggin' demigods of manhood to get in the little can and go do what they did.
Right.
I mean, those guys forever, you know?
Yeah.
Okay? But all I'm saying is it doesn't make sense to me that the dog and pony show would be the first time we attempted it. Bullshit. Particularly at the height of the damn Cold War. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, the same people that would tell me I'm full of shit on this will tell you, but we were secretly doing this other stuff with Google. It's like, you know, make up your mind. Yeah. Either we didn't operate that way or we did. You can't be, you know, over, you know, selective in that. But, it's this book. We haven't nearly, you know, it's, as you know, there's just.
That's a scratch the surface book.
Yeah, we've just barely scratched the surface, and I hope it is interesting to people. It's I'll tell you, it's my most popular book I've ever written. It's only been out 2 months. And
how many have you been on? You've already been on shows talking about
I've been on really just a couple talking specifically about the book.
Right.
And I don't recall that the host had read the book yet. If I'm forgetting somebody, I apologize. But I think you're the first one who's actually read the book thoroughly. I mean, they're familiar with it, or they saw my speech at the thing. So I've talked about it in general terms, but I don't think I've talked specifically about the book on a show, actually. So,
well, that's good. I'm glad this is the first one, and it kicks my butt to post it a little quicker. Soraya was on. I did one from home a couple weeks ago. So he will – was it here or was it home? I can't remember. But Soraya Azakoth, whose real name I'm not sure of, but he has a great podcast called Where Did the Road Go? I will post that here in the next couple of weeks, and then Walter. And I've got a whole bunch of other stuff sitting in the wings there. I've got the show with Joshua Cutchin, and we tried to out-weird each other with bad music or weird music. And I've got discussions with Burnt State and Miguel, and you know a bunch of little things. But you know,
did we hit everybody's questions who emailed them in or messaged?
There was one. Yeah, the only question came in from Steve. I told you, and we hit like all my questions. Except
I would like to say again, anyone you know interested, by all means.
No, we did hit them all.
Yeah. By all means, read my book, Origin, but also if you're interested in this after my book or before my book or whatever, you know, Dennis Crenshaw, P.G. Navarro, Theo Pymans, Stephen Romano, Sean Castile, and Tim Swartz's book, and Michael Busby. You know, those guys really, I listed in the
Yeah, you're very cool to give these people credit.
Well, because these are the guys I initially learned the Delshow material from and got, you know, so much insight. These are the guys that have gone there before me. Mm-hmm. I just tried to take it, you know, what I tried to do is take all the things I learned from their books and analyze it and put together what I see added with my additional research and what I saw rising to the surface and following the leads that naturally came from that. And excuse me, I see it as I think that what I present here will serve a lot to explain a lot of the UFO mystery of the 20th century.
Okay. The book is called Origin, the 19th Century Emergence of 20th Century Breakaway Civilizations by my guest friend and former co-host for a while, Walter Bosley. And I don't know why Walter doesn't come here more often.
Gas is cheaper now. What it was, honestly, was my budget was tight. Yeah. I'm broke. And gas got ridiculously expensive. But with gas being cheaper now,
I got to take advantage here. I'm not going to be here for the next 2 weeks because guess what? Coast to coast. So
hey, cool. How's that gig going?
That is going fine. I can almost say I'm enjoying it, mainly because I kind of get to see it from the inside. And once you do that, like when I interviewed, you didn't hear it, but I interviewed Cassidy Nicholas, who's a official in MUFON, and basically I said, "What the hell?" And she said, "It's not that way," and she explained to me how it was not that way. So the same thing happened when I went coast to coast. It's like, okay, I understand what's going on. I still don't like the way
it's... Is there a studio like this one?
No. I do it at home.
Oh. Oh, wow. Okay. You do your part from home.
Yeah. All I do is web stuff. I do no production, anything like that. I don't answer emails or anything like that. I just make sure that the web is correct before the show. And then after the show, put the show, you know, whatchamacallit, the write-up for the show.
Okay.
Which is sometimes torture.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the other night, I'm so glad I wasn't on working that night, because it was David Jacobs and Michael Sala. I could not do a write-up for them without saying something. I was just like... You know, it'd be almost as bad as if they had Sean Morton on, who's, I think he got out of jail recently, but he's still going to be on trial.
So he did go into jail.
Yes, they arrested him when he came off the boat, off the Conspira cruise. Yeah. They threw him in jail, and then I think Skyler told me his bail was like $100. Like, what? I'm sure that's not right.
Yeah.
He's being accused of bilking people out of, I don't know how many, like serious at least $1 million,
right?
Or more than $1 million.
Yeah.
And his bail's $100.
Maybe he's got a great lawyer.
Or he's not really a flight risk or whatever the hell, but
yeah.
Anyway. The guy's a scumbag. So, yes, we did get to 9. I've got probably like 30 questions here. We got to 28 of them.
Oh, cool.
So, and the ones we didn't get to are so involved and yeah. You know, detail filled that it's like, that's how I kind of
skipped them. Yeah, it's, and I apologize if I'm kind of like, you're asking me to answer questions on my own book. I'm so into the next book that. It's
I 100% understand.
Yeah.
Because you've written, you know, what, a 200 and how many pages?
200 and, well, it's actually, it's 330.
Yeah.
340 pages. But remember, this one I did in 60 days from starting, you know, to.
You bastard.
Do and to publishing. And remember, last summer, I came out with the Burton book.
Yeah.
Which is a 500-page book or something.
Yeah, it's a big book.
And it was it was like 5 months of pure research.
Yeah. If people want to order the hard copy of the paper, they can do that, right?
Yeah, they can get it at lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got a discount price. And,
I'm going to have to talk to you about that.
Okay.
Because I want to see because I'm just about to release this, like, probably Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure between the two and how they rip you off or whatever. So.
They don't rip you off. It's
No. I don't think Lulu does. I want to try and encourage people to order through Lulu if they're ordering the hard copy, which will be the only one.
Right.
Because I make, like, goddamn, like, 8 times the amount of money.
Oh, yeah. You make more money on...
On the paperback.
See, and that's the other thing. You know, when I say this is my most popular book, believe me... I ain't buying a new car. And the shirt I'm wearing is, you know, like 13 years old, that kind of thing. It's just relatively speaking.
Yeah.
It is.
You were pleasantly surprised that it's made a little bit of money.
Exactly. And that's the lion's share of that is the Kindle. You know, I'm selling some printed ones too, but it's mostly the Kindle.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, you know, there's still some people out there that think, oh, you're a writer, you must be making a bunch of money. And that couldn't be further from the truth. You know, I don't do these.
The only people that get that idea are people that haven't written anything
yet. And I clearly don't do these for the money because, you know.
No, I mean, you could go and do something
kind
else.
Of obscure.
Yeah, you go do something else for money. You do this because you want to.
Yeah, this stuff it compels me. I'm compelled, I can't not write and present the stuff that I'm presenting. So it is a labor of love.
Yeah. The power of Del Show compels you.
That's good. Well, I'm hoping the new one will, Secret Missions 3.
Maybe?
I was shooting for May, but I'm hoping to have it out by this summer.
Any indication what it is, or are you going to leave it for now?
I don't want to tip my hand because I don't want someone to beat me to it.
I understand.
But I will tell you this. The individual, unnamed, who this is about, I thought was pretty cool before. And the more I learn about him, I just have endless admiration for the guy. I like the guy. Everything about him was totally cool.
Nice.
And, good character and integrity. And there's a story there that hasn't been told, and I'm hoping to at least flash a little light on that if I can. And but it'd probably be the last of the so-called Secret Missions books because that'll be three Secret Missions books that I've done. Really four because I kind of count Friends from Sonora as a Secret Missions book, the first one. So.
Do you count the fictional novel as one?
You mean the time travel novel?
Yeah.
So, no, that's not really a Secret Missions book.
That's true.
Yeah. But
I like it.
That's I have an editor who's editing that, because sometimes people bitch about, you know, oh, the editing, and you know, that's one of my peeves when the first thing out of their mouth is an editing issue, editorial issue. My fiction is in the process of being revised. It'll be, you know, a lot of it'll be re-released.
Oh, okay.
New cover art, that kind of thing. So, but the time travel novel that Greg's referring to does connect to the Empire of the Wheel books. So
it explicates many of the ideas in a fictional context, which makes them actually it made them more understandable to me.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's very fun.
Your honors. What music do you want to hear at the end here? I'll just type it into YouTube. I've started this in the last 6 months. I've started this tradition because I keep playing stuff I want to hear. It's like, mm-hmm. Here's something that somebody wants to hear.
I try to think of something thematic, but there's not too many airship mystery.
There is a song called "Come Take a Ride on My Airship."
There, of course, is the song, what is it, Ride Captain Ride or whatever?
Yeah. Come take a trip on my airship.
I once loved a sailor. Once a sailor loved me. But he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing. And every evening at midnight, he would come to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars. We'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon. So come take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon. We never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my